On this week's program, a conversation with the renowned German pianist Christian Zacharias. Susan Lewis profiles the recently formed Philadelphia Wind Symphony. And as fragments of an unfinished Sibelius masterwork come to light, David Patrick Stearns considers whether we're about to hear a new Sibelius symphony more than half a century after the death of the great Finnish composer. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
In the past decade or so, Christian Zacharias has gone from being a respected, highly achieving musician to, well, another higher level of artistic and creative maturity. This evolution is evident on his latest recording of Mozart piano concertos, in which he conducts the Lausanne Chamber Orchestra from the keyboard. Now in his early 60s, Zacharias first came to broader public attention in 1969, when at age 19 he won the Geneva International Music Competition. His international career took flight after wins at the Van Cliburn Competition in 1973 and the Ravel Competition in 1975. He made his debut as a conductor in 1992 with the Orchestra de la Suisse Romande, and since then has had a dual career as a pianist and conductor. He's been principal conductor of the Lausanne Chamber Orchestra since 2000, principal guest conductor of the Gothenburg Symphony Orchestra since 2002, and since 2009 an artistic partner of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. Christian Zacharias is also a collector of modern and contemporary art, and much of the mostly paintings he owns come from artists who operate outside the influence of the mainstream. I met with Christian Zacharias in December. Listening to this new Mozart disc, there's a real sense that you continue to evolve as an interpreter of his works. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's better than the other way around, I would say.
Many musicians get to a point where they say, I'm good enough.
Yeah, now certainly this is the way I always used to go, and I'm happy it works, it still works. And of course it's difficult to define what it is. And in short-term relations, it's also often the case when I do a program 3-4 times, then people come after the third time, oh, even better than yesterday. And the fourth time, oh, better than yesterday. And then, of course, I always think, oh, it must have been terrible at the beginning of this week, you know. But it's difficult. Also for me, it's very difficult to decide because it's your personal opinion. What is good and how did you feel? Sometimes you feel great and the result is poor. Sometimes you feel very depressed and you played like a god or something like this. Yeah. So your personal...
Great art coming out of great misery.
Yeah.
The sense of elegance surrounding Mozart has been overblown. I would suggest to you that what you're bringing to the table now, and this is not to suggest that you weren't doing it before, is that there's an incredible emotional honesty in your playing, and that seems to be getting more so. Is that conscious, or is that just you getting older?
I mean, if it's, honesty can't be conscious. I mean, if there you use a word which is the most difficult to produce on purpose, you know. So I'm very happy. I always wanted to be honest. But maybe when you start, there's something in front of it or you don't get to the bottom of what you really want to express. And I have a feeling, too, that things are more just how they are. I mean, that's it, you know. Take it or leave it, you know. This is maybe this kind of honesty. So I'm not trying to produce, which I actually never did, to try to beautiful or pretty things. Actually, pretty is terrible. This is almost the worst. And if I'm very close to honest, I'm very happy because this is where I always wanted to be. And sometimes you are afraid of it. Maybe you beauty is also something we look for. And of course, if it comes with it, it's a bonus. But just to go for this kind of beauty thing is very dangerous. I think.
And there's nowhere to hide with Mozart, right?
No, and he's like a mirror. I mean, there he's very close to Schubert, too. And if you are dishonest, he shows immediately to the audience, too. Here's the mirror, look at this guy, what he's producing. He's trying to pretend.
He's trying to impress you, worse
again. Yeah, even that.
But are there composers, then, who you can embellish and it makes the music somehow more beautiful, more sophisticated?
Yeah, maybe not more, but it doesn't kill the music. I would always say my attitude is always don't do too much because it's still a little dishonest. But say Chopin, for example, of course, is easier because his music carries that in it, you know, and which still wouldn't say...
It almost invites you to embellish.
Yeah, but which wouldn't say that I, even in playing Chopin, I would also try to be very, very down to earth and say what really seems to be said there. And that, of course, brings you to a certain moment that certain pieces are not for you there anymore. You discard certain pieces. Whereas in Mozart's piano concertos, even if there are younger ones or simpler ones, there's still not a single one I would discard because they all carry something very essential. Whereas, say, certain nocturnes or certain... I mean, it's not Kitsch, but Mr. Kitsch is softly knocking on the door, you know.
A lot of musicians really want to have a sense of who the composer was in order to be able to interpret what they wrote. You're not like that.
Now, yeah, of course I study and I'm interested and I read the letters or often by chance discover certain sideways and I'm fascinated. But to know, say, when Mozart and for whom he wrote it and how he felt this morning and what he was eating doesn't help you a bit how to play that piece. I mean, the music is in the end the only guideline and also the only judge at the piece. I firmly believe that a great artist, be it a writer or a composer or a painter, when the piece leaves him, the art piece leads its own life. And that's the judge. And whether he was a weak guy or a strong guy or... I mean, it helps you to get a picture. And, of course, you are probably less prone to complete errors because of style and history and all this kind of thing. And for me, that's why the visual arts are also so fascinating. They are even more independent because a great painting can even say, forget this guy who painted it. You know, I'm here and I'm in 400 years here, I'm in 800. I don't even change because the music pieces change because with interpretation. But a great painting does not change. I mean, maybe our look at it changes, but the piece itself is there. And that taught me also a little bit, go to the piece and try to learn from that. And when I do a Mozart piano concerto or a late Beethoven piano sonata, the piece itself has so many challenges and so many thoughts which you can have about it or alter or revise and so on. Okay, sometimes with a little hint from historic things or a little hint from an instrument Beethoven used or something like this. But in general, please take this as your plan or your itinerary, travel itinerary.
It's all there on the page.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, considering as well that Mozart wrote some of his most astonishing music when history would suggest he was living an astonishingly unhappy or unfulfilling life. He was in terrible physical health. He was constantly grumpy with those around him, yet he was producing amazingly beautiful music.
But he was also, I mean, that doesn't always say that's a bit the romantic view or the genius suffering and then great. But he also was very successful. I mean, when he started his great piano concertos, those were the most successful years in his career. 1784, about, he started in Vienna, he was the superstar. They wanted him. He had a career. He sold tickets like never again, you know, and he wrote the greatest music. So it can also be like this. And the other thing is, when you know what's another aspect of, is the life or is all this important, he also wrote pretty poor things. I mean, he wrote terrible symphonies. I mean, and then I can know, and everybody tells me he's the greatest genius on earth, but I can give you 20 Mozart symphonies, which are really, I mean, the worst Haydn symphony is still better than any of those about 20.
And he wrote a hell of a lot more of them.
Yeah, yeah. And he was the genius and we all sit like this. So I think, again, the piece tells you what is quality. The piece tells you what it wants from you.
Christian Zacharias. His latest CD is his 7th volume of Mozart piano concertos in which he conducts the Lausanne Chamber Orchestra from the piano.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Many of us associate band music with marches or popular American favorites played in schools or at holiday celebrations or during sports and military ceremonies. But ensembles of wind, brass and percussion instruments can perform a wide variety of music. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the history and future of band music as one ensemble, the Philadelphia Wind Symphony, aims to go beyond the stereotype of what a band should be.
P people have been making music with their breath for centuries, and many of us today have a wind or brass instrument in our past, maybe still in its case in the back of the closet or under the bed. Conductor Virginia Allen, a faculty member at the Curtis Institute of Music and the University of the Arts, who has a history of service in military bands, founded the Philadelphia Wind Symphony partly to fill a void.
I kept running into people around the city who had played an instrument at some time. There are a lot of people that play high school and into college, and once they graduate, they don't really have an ensemble to play with.
Allen reached out to people like horn player Brittany Devereaux, who studied music in college but now works for an HR consulting firm.
I don't know if I was the first, but I felt like I responded right away, like, yes, yes, please.
Devereaux is also chair of PR and marketing efforts for the group. Its general manager, Keith Rockley, is a high school music teacher who plays piano and can pick up a trumpet if needed.
There's a large number of music teachers actually in the ensemble. It's really nice to be back in the seat of the performer. In the short amount of time we've been doing this, it's helped me in my teaching to remember that, oh, things are different on the other side of the stand.
While the word symphony refers to a large-scale musical composition, it's also been claimed as a name for ensembles that perform the genre, usually orchestras. So what is a wind symphony?
It's a group of musicians who play woodwind, brass, and percussion. And I decided to use the term wind symphony because it's a smaller type group.
Smaller at around 50 musicians than a concert band, which can include over 100 players. Wind symphonies often have one player per part.
I also chose the name Wind Symphony rather than the Philadelphia Band because some people are turned off by the word band, and they immediately think Sousa marches or pops music. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's beautiful music that's written in both of those genres, but some people don't realize that there is this whole set of repertoire that's as serious as any orchestral or chamber music that you would want to hear. And it explores different colors than you're going to hear in other kinds of ensembles.
Music written for bands often does reflect its roots in the armed forces.
The military decided that they wanted to have bands to support the troops and to maintain the morale of the troops.
Beyond marches, for years, much of the music that a band would play in concert had been transcribed from orchestral works. In 1994, Morten Laridsen's popular choral setting of the liturgical chant, O Magnum Mysterium, was also arranged for band.
There are moments in there that are very, very intimate, but then at the high point in the middle of it is this glorious moment that just everyone opens up and plays a nice full round sound, and it's a nice set of contrasts between it, and it's just this big warm sound that's coming out of the ensemble.
It can also be tricky, says Allen, who has done transcriptions herself, to give lines written for voice or strings to winds.
You have to realize that the instruments themselves and the players don't have the same kind of capabilities. And there are little techniques that you can use sometimes to be able to pull the music together. It's identifying the right instrumental color that will match with something in the strings, and then really being able to balance out the dynamics as well.
In this version of Dvorak's Carnival Overture, the clarinet section plays lines written for strings. ''1909 was a watershed year for the wind ensemble repertoire. English composer Gustav Holst wrote one of the first symphonic works for band, First Suite in E-flat.
It's a chaconne, which is a type of fugue, where the bass line keeps repeating, but he introduces this theme in the tubas. And it's this very nice, very lyrical theme. It's just for 8 measures, and it sets up the whole rest of the movement, and it's amazing to hear with those 8 measures all the variation he goes through. Every color is explored.
In the second movement, it's very chamber-like and very intimate, and I love the second movement. I would just like play it over and over and over again. The third movement is more of like a British march.
And one of the other things that he did in the last movement is to use some folk songs in there. So that makes it the kind of tune that you can go away singing.
Over the last century, more composers have written explicitly for winds, with growth in the repertoire fueled by commissions from colleges as well. Contemporary composers, in turn, have looked for new possibilities that this instrumentation allows.
Even new instruments, especially back in the percussion section, a lot of wind ensemble pieces have really pushed the envelope with new instruments and using instruments in different ways.
People are always exploring the combination of sounds within wind ensembles. There's a piece, Ecstatic Waters, by Stephen Bryant. Just all sorts of colors and sounds that you can combine in there. To have the capability to combine that maybe with some of the traditional music is really very exciting.
The Philadelphia Wind Symphony aims to celebrate both tradition and innovation. The group is working with the University of the Arts, which provides space and the possibility of multimedia presentations involving student singers, dancers, and other artists.
I see endless possibilities of different things that we'll be doing, not just people coming in and seeing an ensemble sitting on the floor and playing, but a lot of different creative ways to collaborate with other performing artists.
No matter what you call it, an ensemble of brass, woodwinds, and percussion can still get feet tapping and arm swinging at holiday celebrations or sports events, in military barracks, and in concert halls. A band or wind symphony can also be a canvas for complex new works, a place where instruments we've known since childhood take center stage and explore music in a new way.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Philadelphia Wind Symphony's next performance is a week from tomorrow at Kaplan Hall at the University of the Arts in Center City, Philadelphia. Though it's only a snippet of music, Philadelphia orchestra goers will know immediately who wrote it, the great Finnish composer John Sibelius, whose music has been core repertoire for the ensemble since the Ormonde years. But if the piece itself is impossible to place, it's because it was only heard for the first time in Helsinki last fall, when sketches for the composer's long in progress but never completed Symphony No. 8 were played in a few isolated fragments by the Helsinki Philharmonic Orchestra. But can scholars finish an opus that the composer could not, or should they? The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns spoke to sources both in Finland and closer to home, and emerged with no assurances that the Sibelius Symphony No. 8 will ever be heard in full.
Music scholars are always in search of the great lost symphony, the end-of-life piece that could sum up everything previous and go one step beyond. Gustav Mahler, Edward Elgar, and Anton Bruckner have all had their final opuses finished by others, often to great acclaim. The Symphony No. 8 occupied John Sibelius from 1927 on, though all the world heard was 30 years of silence ending in the composer's death in 1957. During that time, he proclaimed the 8th Symphony to be nearly finished and even scheduled a premiere date in 1932 with the Boston Symphony Orchestra, only to change his mind, saying, "I've had all sorts of interruptions. Please don't advertise any performance." It is believed that he finished the symphony maybe several times in different versions, burned it in the mid-1940s, and possibly started over. So, where is it? Helsinki music critic and Sibelius scholar Vesa Siren got wind of other scholars who had been sifting through the composer's papers and found orchestrated fragments for the Eighth Symphony. Siren arranged to have the Helsinki Philharmonic play them. What was it like to first hear the piece that had defeated Finland's greatest composer?
My hands shook a little, and the woman next to me, who is a publicist of Helsinki Philharmonic, started to cry. And it was a historic moment, because for so many decades we have imagined what it could have been like. Was he searching for some new style? Was it something like Seventh Symphony? Was it something entirely different? The harmonies are quite bold. And when I heard the sketches, I realized that he knew exactly what he was doing. The sound world was genuinely Sibelian, but also a Sibelian in some new, previously unknown direction.
The excerpts were recorded and posted on the website of the newspaper Helsingin Sanomat, where Siren is employed. Opinions differ as to whether the piece can be completed. The surviving sketches are thought to have been made early in the piece's gestation, but there are 800 pages of them. Scholars are often wary of jumping to grand conclusions. Siren and others gingerly describe the sketches not as the Eighth Symphony, but as something dating from the period of the Eighth Symphony. Even orchestrated fragments heard here are what Siren calls close contenders. One scholar, however, has said that the 800 pages are mostly the same piece, and the symphony is indeed finishable, and you never know what unknown materials might show up that could bring the two scholarly sides closer together. Sibelius hired a copyist named Paul Vogt to translate his script into something that working musicians could read, and Siren spoke to the copyist's descendants.
Her granddaughter actually phoned to me and said, okay, we don't have symphony number 8 in our attic. But 2 hours later, she phoned me again, saying that actually I looked more closely to my late father's belongings, or how do you say, and I actually found 5 letters from Sibelius to Paul Vogt. And so after 2 hours, she found these. So I'm still hopeful that maybe after some more weeks, someone somewhere gets interested and might find some more.
What could it have been like for a composer of Sibelius's stature to burn decades of work? Vesa Siren is 2 degrees removed from a near eyewitness to the event, having interviewed Sibelius's grandson, Erkki Virkkunen, who arrived at the family's homestead one night in the 1940s to discover his grandmother, the composer's wife Aina, to be quite upset.
And he asked, what has happened? And Aino Sibelius said that there has been a great bonfire here, and she was totally shocked. And Grandpa, Jean Sibelius himself, he didn't make a big thing out of it, seemed more a subject of humor than anything. So he was not satisfied, and he was very upset of the idea that people like me might actually publish something. So he thought that his symphony number 8 is not worth to be published in that form, so he burned it.
Some have speculated that the bonfire was the composer's way of restarting the symphony with a clean slate. Certainly, the piece was still on his mind, says Siren.
In early 1950s, when he was a very old man, he said that, okay, it's ready in sketches, but I haven't had the power to actually write it through. So there's a contradiction there, or is there? Is it even possible that he continued to sketch out the symphony even after he had burned it?
What could have been going through the composer's head as he held back the symphony time and again? At that point, Sibelius was very famous. He had a reputation to live up to. He didn't need money. Also, his hands had begun to shake so much that his wife would forge his autograph. One thing that seemed to decrease the shaking was alcohol, something that Sibelius struggled with much of his life. But Siren is almost defensive when it is suggested that alcoholism was a factor in the symphony's unfinished state.
It was usually so that when he worked for months, all day and all of the night, and when the masterpiece was ready, then he thought that, okay, now I'll party so hard, and so he did. But the thing is that if he were a what we call alcoholic that drinks every day lots of alcohol. He wasn't like that. And in 1930s, he mainly stayed at his home where the wife was there all the time. And he certainly didn't want to be, how do you say, drunk as a skunk every day.
As high as the curiosity factor is for the Eighth Symphony, it's hard to know how much conductors are willing to deal with a fragmentary work. When the Philadelphia Orchestra's music director designate, Yannick Nizet-Séguin, heard the three bits posted on the internet, he was more amused than intrigued.
I think the last excerpt has the most naive quality. But, you know, I'm in split minds. I think for musicologists it's great, but I also think that we have sometimes the deleted scenes in DVD, and it does fulfill our sense of wanting to know everything about something, but this feels very much to me as great ideas he had, sketches, but many composers had these, right? And Brahms burnt them all. And maybe...
maybe he had the right idea?
Yeah. Do we really need another symphony that we will try to assemble? Will that help the case of his legacy, Sibelius? I'm not sure.
I disagree, if only because we never know what doors will open, what acts of creative clairvoyance are possible once the right scholar is engulfed in page after page of the composer's manuscripts. The Elgar Third Symphony was considered to be a hopeless case, even as fragments were played over the BBC. But somehow, those scraps turned into a fully-fledged symphony in which the composer's voice is loud and clear. So the Sibelius Eighth is still worth a try. I'm willing to bet that if the completion doesn't work, our ears will tell us immediately, just as they told us in these tiny fragments, that this was Sibelius speaking in a way that we'd never previously heard, just as he spoke to us in his great, great Seventh Symphony.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. That's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.